So this case is People versus Childress. May I have the entry of appearance and starting with the petitioner, please?
Good morning, Reggie Gillespie.
Gillespie, thank you. For the defendant, Ms. Griffin?
Elizabeth Griffin, registered for 2328.
All right. Thank you very much. Counsel, this case is set for 30 minutes. That means each side is only 15. So you'll need to keep track of your time. If you wish to reserve any time, you need to do so yourself, please. And whenever you're ready, may go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. This case concerns the applicability of complicity liability to vehicular assault and state liability crime. Both the plain language of the complicity statute and its interpretation by this court make it clear that complicity liability applies to unintentional crimes, which include state liability offenses. The statute reads, a person is legally accountable as principal for the behavior of another constituting a criminal offense if, with the intent to promote or facilitate the commission of the offense, he or she aids, abets, advises, or encourages the other person in planning or committing the offense. Now, nothing in this statutory language implies a requisite culpable mental state for the crime committed by the principal. Instead, the focus is on the principal's behavior constituting a criminal offense. This emphasis on behavior, in fact, can be seen throughout the part of the statute governing the complicity liability. For example, under 601, 81601, the heading is liability based on behavior. And then stating that a person is guilty of an offense if it is committed by the behavior of another person for which he is legally accountable. Section 602 similarly has the heading behavior of another and then describes when someone is legally accountable for the behavior of another person. 604 again states exemptions for liability based upon behavior of another. So it is clear that the focus of the complicity liability, according to the statute, the plain meaning of the statute, is the conduct or the behavior leading to the criminal offense, not the result of that offense.
But there is an intent element mentioned in complicity, is there not? Or in that statute you just read?
Yes, there is an element of intent, and I will address that, but the intent goes to the conduct, not to the result of the offense, and that is what
of the complicitor, the complicitor's intent to facilitate the underlying offense. Just help me out with the language, will you?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Is it the intent of the complicitor to facilitate the crime? I'm just straighten me out there. It's a strict liability crime. The complicitor has some kind of intent element. You read it, right?
As this court has held, again, the intent to commit the crime has been interpreted as the intent to commit the acts and the conduct underlying that crime. And that's the focus of the complicity statute as interpreted by this court. And that's the significance of all the cases from Beeler to Grissom, that the intent is the common meaning of the intent, because complicity liability is not an offense by itself. It is a theory of liability. So the statutory definition of intent, which is applied to specific to offenses defined by the statute is not applicable here. What we have here is the common meaning of intent, which, again, in the context of complicity, goes to the intent to facilitate the underlying act. In Wheeler and Grissom, this court held that complicity liability applies to unintentional crimes of criminally negligent homicide and reckless manslaughter. There is no principal reason to treat strict liability differently from those unintentional crimes. If aiding and abetting criminally negligent behavior or reckless behavior is blameworthy and punishable, so is aiding and abetting driving under the influence, which is the behavior at issue in this case.
Okay, counsel, can I just stop you there, though? I guess you're going to the policy behind the case law or the crimes, but I'm wondering if you could directly address the language in those cases that say the complicitor must have the culpable mental state required for the underlying crime. Help me understand the word culpable in the context of a strict liability crime that is not, has no culpability. How does that work?
The word culpability has been used in Bogdanov, and that is the only ground, actually, the Court of Appeals used not to apply complicity liability in this case, relying on that language. However, the language used in Bogdanov, first of all, addressed was used in the context of the crime at issue there, which was intentional crime, burglary and theft. Secondly, even culpable has not been used in Bogdanov consistently. The statement, the word culpable is used as part of the dual mental state that is described in Bogdanov, but at several locations in that decision, the word culpable has not been used. So it is not clear that the culpable element was meant to be understood as applied to every case. And
well, did we just make a mistake using that word?
Again, in the context of intentional crimes, that would make sense. And also, if we read the language carefully, it doesn't mean that because culpable is used there, it means that it is part of the requisite mens rea for every crime. Because the statement is that complicity liability exists when the complicitor has the culpable mental state required for underlying crime. I would suggest that the qualification required for the underlying crime suggests that if there is such a requirement, then obviously the complicitor must have that mens rea mental state. But it doesn't suggest that unless there is a culpable mental state, then complicity liability does not apply.
So essentially, I guess you would we should just ignore the word culpable, basically, and just say the mental state of the crime is applicable to complicitor, and here, essentially, we have strict liability, so there's no mental state.
I would suggest that's the proper reading of Bogdanov, given the nature of the case, the crime involved, and the fact that at several places the word culpable was not even used in Bogdanov itself.
Okay, then how, just help me understand, how does the intent requirement in the complicitor statute actually apply?
In the context of strict liability?
Strict liability.
Again, I would go back to Wheeler, which was reaffirmed in Bogdanov and Grissom, that the word intent to facilitate the crime goes to the behavior and the conduct at issue, not the commission. So the commission of the crime actually is interpreted as the underlying behavior leading to that crime. For criminal negligence, homicide, criminally negligent homicide, which was the issue in Wheeler, the behavior was simply criminally negligent behavior, not intending the death, which was an element of criminally negligent homicide. The same thing goes with strict liability. Here what we have is driving under the influence, which resulted in serious bodily injury. So the crime is vehicular assault, DUI. But the behavior at issue and the intent that is relevant here is the intent to facilitate and aid that conduct which is driving under the influence. We still have the element of intent because there's no question that compensatory liability is not a strict liability theory. We need to have the intent in order to convict someone of that.
Again, it's the intent of the complicit, right?
I'm sorry.
Didn't you just say it was the intent of the complicit? I want to return to my original question. For examining the intent of the complicit.
Yes, the complicit must intend to facilitate the conduct of the principal, whatever that conduct is, whether it is reckless behavior under Grissom, criminally negligent behavior in Wheeler, or here, driving under the influence. I would suggest there's no principal reason again to differentiate among all these behaviors because they are all unintentional crimes and they all fall under the complicity theory acknowledged in these cases.
Counsel, if I could jump in for just a second. To the extent this notion that the complicit must share the culpable mental state of the principal, and we cite that and O'Donnell, we cite Lafayette, and I'm wondering if you have any insights as to the purpose of that requirement. Does it serve sort of a protective purpose for the complicit, or what thoughts do you have to share on why that requirement exists?
It would go to the notion of having some intent in the participation in the act, that it is, by sharing, it is not meant that it would be identical, as a matter of fact, because the principal may eventually be convicted of a higher crime,
right,
as we know, under 18.1605. But as far as sharing the intent to promote the behavior that is at issue, that is required of the complicitor to make sure that it is not an unintentional aiding and abetting that results somehow innocently in promotion of the crime. So sharing that intent makes sure that we are not talking about any strict liability for the complicit.
Strict liability for the complicitor.
For the complicit.
So how does it play out when the principal, when the crime committed by the principal is a strict liability offense? What does the complicitor have to know? And I raise this because your opposing counsel says, well, what about the hypothetical where I just hand somebody the keys and I don't happen to know that he is intoxicated?
Again, it goes to the definition of or application of the requirement of aiding, abetting, and furthering that crime. If the goal is to assist the principal in committing that crime, that is sufficient to hold the complicit liable. The definition of, in terms of factually what circumstances must exist to reach that conclusion, of course, depends on specific cases. And that's a decision to be made by the prosecution, whether to charge the person with such a crime, and for the jury to decide whether there was sufficient evidence to convict the person of that crime. But in terms of the intent, there must be an intent to promote that.
So in this context, with vehicular assault DUI, what would the prosecution need to show that the complicitor knew or understood? What should have they intended to aid or about? To facilitate the commission's crime.
The facts of this case are good examples. Here what we have is the father who assists his 17-year-old son, both prior to this incident by providing alcohol, and then driving himself recklessly while being under the influence. And then on the way back to their party site, he encourages the son to drive faster. We have all the factors relevant here to decide whether there was sufficient intent, sufficient evidence to show that the father had the intent to promote that behavior.
And do you conceive of any circumstances shy of that that would also qualify
I mean, what is your response, I suppose, to your opponent's argument? Someone could be then liable as a complicit or simply for handing over the keys to someone who turns out to be intoxicated. Are you saying that the complicit at least needs to be aware that this person is intoxicated and intends to drive? Okay, that's all I wanted to clarify.
Yes, certainly.
So your answer to me then was, I guess you suggested to me that you just have to intend to commit the acts. You just intentionally have to turn the keys over. So that's incorrect, I guess. I'm just trying to understand your opinion, or your position.
As opposed to having the knowledge that this is happening?
Right. I mean, I heard you tell me that you simply have to intend the acts that constitute the crime. You don't have to intend the crime. So where does the knowledge of intoxication come from?
Well, that's part of the intent. If the person, like here, if the father didn't know that the son was under the influence, then obviously that would not constitute an intent to facilitate that behavior. So it is part of the intent requirement for the complicit to be aware of the condition of the principal. Here is the son. And then facilitate that behavior.
Okay, thank you.
So let me ask another question. So is it what you're saying that the complicitor has to intend each of the elements of the specific intent crime, which are in this particular instance that the person was drunk, he was driving, and that he caused an accident?
Not, Your Honor, not intending for him to get drunk, but as far as the intent to facilitate the crime is concerned, if the complicitor has the knowledge and then encourages the person to drive, that is sufficient, even though he may not have encouraged him to drink prior to that. But what I pointed out was that here we have the series of events that remove any doubt that the father here was aware of the condition of the son, and also at the same time encouraged through his own behavior as well as by encouraging the son to drive fast.
Okay. Thank you.
So we ask the court to reverse the court of appeals. Thank you.
Ms. Griffin.
May it please the court, Elizabeth Griffin for Kenneth Childress. I basically have three primary arguments for why our complicity statute does not apply to a strict liability crime. And the first is really the most simple, and that's the Court of Appeals reasoning in this case, and the one that Justice Ide was asking about. And that is that in Bogdanoff, you repeatedly said that a complicitor must act with the culpable mental state required for the underlying crime. The court did not say the culpable mental state, if any, which is the way the model penal code puts that result provision, which we don't have. It did not say any culpable mental state. It said the culpable mental state. And I think that's a very valid way to resolve this case, since I'm here, though.
But that crime involved a culpable mental state, did it not?
Which crime?
It wasn't a strict liability crime.
In Bogdanoff.
Yeah.
Correct.
Right. So it was purely describing that particular crime.
Well, I mean,
that phraseology.
Bogdanoff, I think, spoke very generally to the complicity requirements in Colorado. It's true that the crime at issue was a burglary and maybe a theft. I'm not sure about that. But I think if you read the opinion, it seems very clear that the court was trying to make this very kind of global explanation of what's required.
Yeah, but it didn't have, you know, strict liability crimes, as I understand it, are a very narrow category of crimes. There aren't very many of them, correct?
So it's
an example of making a general statement and an opinion that becomes too general when it comes to another classification that's an exception.
Well, I mean, I guess I would say, I would agree with you to the extent that probably the court in Bogdanoff didn't foresee this argument today, because I don't think most people would have foreseen this argument today. This isn't, complicity statute isn't generally applied to strict liability offenses, which is why this hasn't come before you. So I think you're right that the court wasn't specifically thinking about this situation, but the reason is actually because people didn't think you could apply it that way, and people didn't apply it that way.
Counsel, could I ask if you have a response to your opponent's focus on the following wording that creates culpable mental state required for the underlying crime? If we look at that entire phrase, could we not interpret that to mean whatever the requisite culpable mental state happens to be, and in this case, there is no requisite culpable mental state?
Well, I don't think that would be a reasonable interpretation, because there was a clear model in the Model Penal Code for addressing result crimes and addressing them differently. And in that provision, which is 2.06 subsection 4 of the Model Penal Code, which existed long before we enacted the statute in 1971, they said for result crimes that the complicitor has to act with the culpable mental state, if any, for the underlying crime. Now, when our legislature enacted this statute, of course, they were very aware of the Model Penal Code. And in Grissom, this court actually said that our legislature very deliberately chose to enact a statute that was different in certain ways from the Model Penal Code. And for our purposes today, that's a really significant difference.
And may I ask you the same question I asked your opponent? To the extent we say that in Bogdanoff, and we start with do you have any insights into the common law origins of that, or what the purpose of that requirement is intended to serve?
The sharing of the mental state? Well, I cited a 1939 case from this court in my answer brief, Wilson. So that doesn't really answer your question, but it's a very old requirement. That would be the common law. And Lefebvre cites that case. And I think the kind of obvious reason, yes, is that if you're going to punish the guy who's not actually doing the crime, the same as the guy who is doing the crime, he ought to at least have, you know, as much of a culpable mental state as that guy has.
In that sense, it strikes me that it does serve a protective purpose.
Absolutely.
In other words, to protect the complicitor from being held liable for a crime that the principal who holds a more serious culpable mental state. And if that is the purpose, in this context, I don't know that it's necessary to protect the complicitor when there is no requisite culpable mental state.
Well, I would really like to get to the second part of my argument, but just a real quick answer is that Lefebvre also talks about how strict liability crimes, the reason why complicity, it would be unsound to apply accomplice liability to strict liability crimes, according to Lefebvre, is that there are certain policy reasons for holding the actors, the actual actors who are doing the risky act, liable even if they have no culpable mental state, which is an exception to our rule of law. Generally, our rule of law and due process requires that we don't put people in prison unless they have some culpability. But there are certain very risky things you can do where we say, well, this is so risky that we're not going to require a culpable mental state. Well, if you're one of, 10 people at the party just saying, good night, see you later, and that guy then is in an accident and kills someone, I guess it seems pretty absurd and probably unconstitutional to say all 10 of those people are then going to go to prison for a Class 3 felony.
But doesn't your hypothetical, in fact, sort of conflate strict liability for the driving offense with strict liability for the complicitor's intent? And I'm not seeing that this requirement negates that requisite intent. In other words, your complicitor has to intend to aid the commission of the offense.
Mm-hmm.
Or someone just waving goodbye
I don't see how that reflects any intent to aid commission defense.
Okay, well, this sort of gets to the next part of my argument, which is that complicity doesn't apply to strict liability crimes because our General Assembly said, and they chose to say, that you have to act with the intent to promote or facilitate the commission of the offense, and they chose not to include a provision that treats result crimes any differently when there was a model available in the Model Penal Code that says for a result crime that you have to act with the culpable mental state, if any, required for commission of the offense. Well, they deliberately chose to require the intent to promote or facilitate commission of the offense. So, I mean, maybe Justice Marquez, what you're asking is if there could be a situation or if a person could be an accomplice if they actually intended for this guy to go out and kill someone. I don't think that's really what our General Assembly was anticipating or intending. That would certainly be more fair than the scenario that the state proposes, which is that if you know someone's been drinking and then you send them off, that you're guilty of whatever happens.
Before you leave Model Penal Code, just a minute, since we're on that, although our legislature has called this a strict liability offense, I'm clearly referring to the result here, I think. Do you think that a crime of requiring voluntary intoxication is a strict liability offense in the sense that the Model Penal Code uses those terms?
Well, I think so. I mean, I haven't revisited the way the Model Penal Code talks about strict liability offenses, but it certainly seems to me that, you know, the basics of criminal liability are a voluntary act plus a culpable mental state. So the mere fact that you've done a voluntary act doesn't mean you have a culpable mental state.
And we're not talking about voluntarily driving alone. We're talking about driving while you are voluntarily intoxicated.
Mm-hmm.
And does that come closer to something the Model Penal Code would designate recklessness?
Well, I mean,
or negligence.
I think you're voluntarily drinking and you're voluntarily driving. And so to me, that's two voluntary acts. You still don't have a culpable mental state. I hope that answers your question.
Okay.
Basically, my argument is that Bogdanov is correct. That you, when you unanimously decided Bogdanov, that you were setting a course back to our statute, what the General Assembly actually requested. And that Grissom, I think, got off that course because a lot of Grissom uses language that sounds kind of like natural and probable consequences doctrines, which other states have that we don't have. Grissom talks about, well, if you're in a common enterprise with somebody and you know anything, then you're liable for whatever happens. And that's never been the law in Colorado. That's not what our General Assembly has said. We have a statute that requires the intent to promote or facilitate the commission of the offense. And so I think this case actually presents a great opportunity for this court, since my opponent is relying on Wheeler and Grissom, to clarify the law a little bit and to bring it back into line with Bogdanov and with our statute, and in particular to clarify any ambiguity created by some of the language in Grissom, which I think is mistaken, which is not in line with our statute. And I think Rosemont really reinforces that Bogdanov was a correct explanation of what the intent to promote or facilitate means in this type of statute.
I guess the trouble that I'm having, at least, is this is such a perfect fact pattern for, you know, fathers urging a kid who knows he's drunk to drive faster and faster. I mean, it just feels like it's an accomplice situation.
Well, Justice Rice, actually, it's not clear at all that he knew his son was drunk.
Can you tell me about that?
His son did not appear drunk. And he told his girlfriend that he'd only had two drinks over the course of the evening, and his girlfriend thought that was true, and that's why she said, "You drive, here, take the keys." My client wanted to keep driving, and his son took the keys from him, and there was actually an argument about who would drive. So my client, first of all, didn't want his son to drive. Now, fine, my client was drunk and should have been driving too, but that's not what we're talking about here right. for purposes of this liability. So the son actually took the keys from my client, insisted on driving, and apparently the son did not appear to be intoxicated. And if you look at his blood alcohol, it was just barely over the legal limit. So it was just high enough that the jury was told to presume that he was DUI, but apparently he didn't look intoxicated. So I don't think it's quite the way the state describes it.
All right, thank you.
And I really think, as I said near the end of the brief, that if complicity were to be extended to strict liability, that the state is basically asking you to double down on what I think was not a legitimate extension of statutory liability to begin with. That is, the extension of criminal liability to reckless and negligent conduct, where the legislature chose deliberately not to include that provision of the Model Penal Code in our statute. And the state is basically saying, I want you to extend it even more. I want you to double down on Wheeler and Grissom, and that is not consistent with what our General Assembly has enacted, and that is not a legitimate use of the judicial power. And if the court has no other questions, I'll ask you. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. And I'm sorry you're out of time. So this case has been presented to us now. I want to thank you, Mr. Yazdi, and also you, Ms. Strickland, for your argument.